بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على نبينا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. First of all, I'd like to make sure that my supervisor is not attending this lecture. Otherwise, she will give me a hard time. She's already giving me a hard time, but... Okay, actually, I was planning to prepare a presentation, and normally I do this. But SAWAS students normally, they like intellectual discussions, so they don't like technical presentations and sort of stuff. So I decided maybe it's better just to have an intellectual discussion away from presentations and laptops and all these technical things. I think the topic today is quite relevant. And it's a very important topic. Maybe the brothers, mashallah, yani they reflected their caliber and their intellectual side by choosing this topic, Islam and modernity. First of all, just let us cover the topic from a very academic point of view. And maybe you might expect that this vast topic cannot be covered within this short period of time. That's why maybe sometimes we might mention a few things without going into details. We may refer the audience to maybe other references to dig more or to study more about them. And we might skip some important issues because of time constraints. We are talking mainly about Islam and modernity. From an intellectual and an academic point of view, we need to define the topic, the title of the topic that we are discussing. What is Islam and what is modernity? It's not good for us to get into the discussion without understanding the basic terms. And maybe Plato said that many of the debates between people can be easily resolved if they define what they are talking about, if they agree on the definitions of the terms that they are using in their debates. So it is very vital to define Islam, what Islam is, and what modernity is. Islam, simply Islam, is submission to God. I know that many people define Islam as peace, okay, and Islam is derived from the word peace, but this is not right. Islam linguistically is written from the word submit. In the Quran, we see وَمَنْ يُسْلِمْ وَجْهَهُ إِلَى اللَّهِ وَهُوَ مُحْسِنٌ فَقَدْ اسْتَمْسَكَ بِالْعُرْوَةِ الْوُثْقَى. The one who submit, the one who surrenders himself to the will of Allah جل وعلا. So, and linguistically, the word أسلم is taken from to surrender, to submit. To submit yourself to someone and you obey him in all matters. This is simply Islam. Now, this definition is a matter of agreement between all the scholars. There is no room for ijtihad here because it is something that has been discussed by all the scholars from the past, and all linguistic scholars as well discussed it and they came to that conclusion. However, there are many evidences can be taken from the Quran to prove that this is the definition of Islam, to submit your will, to surrender yourself to the will of your Lord or your Creator. In the Quran, all of us, we read, سَلَىٰ رَبِّكَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُكَ فِي مَا شَجَرُ بَيْنَهُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَجِدُوا فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَرَجًا مِمَّا قَضَيْتَ وَيُسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا. They, by your Lord, they don't believe until they take you as a judge in all their matters. And they submit to your decision without hesitating, without finding anything against it in their hearts. And وَإِن تَنَزَعْتُمْ فِي شَيْءٍ فَرُدُّوهُ إِلَى اللَّهِ وَالرَّسُولِ etc. We can quote so many ayat about that. This is Islam. To submit yourself to the will of your Creator. In which area? Economical area, social area, political area, theologically, or spiritually, in all angles. As simple as that. In all angles. Whenever your Lord is giving you any set of guidelines, as he mentioned, and instructions, then you have to follow these guidelines, these instructions. Spiritually, in political sector of life, in economy, in sociology, in all aspects of your life. In a nutshell, what is the philosophy behind that? It's very important. What is the philosophy? Simply, we believe, as and I think many people do, even atheists, they believe that they have been created by a creator. And simply, by just simple rational argument, the creator is the one who knows about what he has created. I have an HP machine. I should not refer to a Sony manual. I should refer to an HP machine. All of you will consider me crazy if I am taking with me a Sony manual to run my HP machine. As simple as that. We believe that we have been created by the God. He knows us better than we understand or we know ourselves. So we have to refer to his manual, where he had written for us all the sets of instructions and guidelines that we need to operate on. We need to work on accordingly. That is the philosophical background of Islam. Now, modernity. What is modernity? In a nutshell, modernity is a term, mainly, as the brother said, that has been introduced by Western thinkers and mainly European thinkers, to refer to a situation where they said that our time is different from the previous time. As simple as that. After or post the industrialized century and, of course, the French Revolution, they have seen that the time now is totally different from the time before the industrialized century and industrialized era. So we need to have a shift in terms of the set of values and instructions and principles. We need to look at the whole world from a different angle. Now, many people, when they talk about modernity, they refer to art and the role that arts can play in modernity, and whether the philosophers they were talking about the role of arts, etc., etc. We don't want to get into that, but in a nutshell, that is modernity. Now, here, it is very, very important for both Muslims and non-Muslims to understand a bit of the history behind modernity and behind all the movements that took place during that time. Normally, when we talk about modernity, we are talking or we are going to refer to some other thoughts that revolved during that time. Mainly, they talk about individualism, they talk about democracy, they talk about industrialized society. During that time, also the social movements took place, many social movements took place, and so on and so forth. And maybe many of you know that we are not anymore talking about modernity, but we are talking about post-modernity. Anyway, we don't want to get into that, but this is, in a nutshell, what modernity is. Now, in terms of history, as I said, it's very important for us to understand a bit of history. During the, just before the industrialized era or century, mainly the Western government, the Western countries, they were suffering from two main things. They were suffering from the aristocracy. Okay, aristocracy during that time, as well as the power of clergy, the Catholic clergy at that time. So they really want to get rid of that. And because of those two important factors, Western people at that time, They were suffering so many discrimination against poor people, against devastated people, against even women, and so on and so forth. Just if we take the example of women, maybe you know that just before the suffrage, women used to face a lot of or many types of discrimination. And they were even degraded and humiliated in Europe. You know that they were not having the right of voting. Many thinkers at that time, they used to look at them that they are intellectually below the man, and they even they have some deficiencies in terms of their intellect. They used to deprive them from many rights. For example, they don't have the right to possess after they married. They don't have to inherit once they are divorced. In terms of divorce, they don't have the right to divorce even. Once they are married, that's it. That's the end of life. If they are not happy with their husbands in their matrimonial life, they have no escape out of it. As a result of all these things, the industrialized revolution, many thinkers said enough is enough. We need now to think about a new set of laws. We need to look at the whole world differently. And many social movements took place, and then they start to talk about modernity. This background is very important, brothers and sisters, colleagues, because now, for example, Islam is being accused that it's a backward religion. And mainly, as we spoke about women, etc., when we talk about women from an Islamic point of view, and we differentiate between men and women, and we say that men have their own rights, women have their own rights. However, there are certain things that women cannot do, as well as there are certain things that men cannot do. They see, the Western people, they see this as a matter of discrimination. And this brings them to the history, their history before the suffrage, that they used to discriminate negatively against women. So they think that Islam is just a continuous or a continuation of that period, that backward period. That's why they think, they strongly believe that Islam is a backward religion, and Islam really needs modernity, especially in this angle, how Islam looks at women. And always you hear, when they talk about Islam, they talk about that Islam discriminates against women, Islam does not give women their rights, Islam deals women badly, etc., etc., etc. They have in their mind the history that has been in Europe and the situation that has been going on in Europe before the suffrage, where they were discriminating against women. This is vital, very important for us to understand once we talk about Islam and modernity. So this is in brief the definition of Islam and the definition of modernity. The second point of this lecture, after the first point, the first part of this lecture is the definition of both terms. The second part of this lecture, I want to have more engagement with yourselves. Here, there is a question. We see, we have mentioned that we, as human beings, went through so many changes, and we have faced this industrialized era. And things have changed. Whether we like it or we don't like it, things have changed. And those changes, they were dramatic changes in all aspects of life, in all fields of life, starting by technology, ending by communication, etc., etc. And those changes are not pure technical changes, but those changes have influence on our day-to-day life. For example, maybe 100 years ago, you cannot visit your relative in America unless you take maybe a boat to go there, and it will take you months. But now you can visit your relatives in America within a few hours. Actually, more than that, you can see your relatives within seconds by internet, Skype or whatever. Okay? So these are really changes. Now, what the question is, these changes are interfering in all aspects of our life. So, what is the position of Islam towards these changes? How do we deal with those changes? Just the first point here, brothers and sisters and colleagues as well, okay, is that let us state a very important foundation. As a society, any society, do we need a set of guidelines that govern our life? Do we need that or we don't need it? A question. Is it a matter of agreement or someone has a different idea? Do we need a set of guidelines, rules that govern our life or don't we?
Yes.
Okay, I think no one can disagree with this. This is a fact, a simple fact. We are living here in this room, okay, in this room, we need a set of guidelines. You haven't mentioned the housekeeping rules, okay, or you haven't mentioned if someone wants to ask a question. No one can just interrupt the speaker and just start talking. This is unethical. Leave alone that it breaks so many rules, simple rules. So we need set of rules and guidelines. Now, when we talk about the set of rules and guidelines, and maybe principles, or you may talk about values, we have those set of values, guidelines, call them whatever you want to call them, and we have our life. Our life is changing. What about those set of rules and guidelines? Do we have to change them to match the changes in our life? Or do we have to control the change in our life? And we say no, because we don't have set of rules and guidelines to match those changes, so we have to suppress and stop those changes and change them to go back to the original situation in order for our set of rules and guidelines to match them. Okay, I hope the question is clear. So we have two options, and someone can introduce a third option. The first option is to say that we have to change the set of rules and guidelines in order to match the changes in our life. Okay? The second option, and this is just from a rational point of view, the second option is to say that we need to suppress and stop those changes, actually change them to go back to the original situation in order for them to match those set of rules and guidelines that we have set previously. Okay, those are the two options. Yeah, is that clear? Very important to understand this. Is there any other option? Yeah? Is there any other alternative?
You can add to the other rules, original rules. You can add to them. Instead of changing the original rules.
Yeah.
You can add to them.
And you leave the other rules without any change.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Abolish all rules and new
ones. Abolish all rules and make new ones. Which mainly is the first option. Just to change those rules and to match these changes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Excellent. That is the third choice that many people put forward, is to have a mix of both. In certain areas, we need to change those rules and guidelines to fit into or to match those changes. And in other areas, we cannot change those set of rules and guidelines. But we need to maybe stop those changes to bring them back to the original set of rules and guidelines. Okay, so this is a combination of both. Now, what is the best choice? Is it the first one, the second one, or the third one? What is the best choice? Third one. Okay, let us talk about the first one, because it is very important to understand the first choice, as many people like to propose it. Okay? When we say that we have certain rules and guidelines that have been set by human beings or by an external authority at a certain period of time, we need to change them in order to match the ongoing changes. What do you think of this choice? Is it a practical choice? Is it a good choice? Does it have any negative consequences or what? It's very important to understand this particular point. Yes?
Can I ask about a clarification? When we speak about the guidelines, which set of the one is exactly speaking about? Are you speaking about the social issues brought forth by Islam, which are present in the Hadith and the Quran? Are we speaking about the ethical issues?
All.
And the solution?
All. All. I'm talking about all. I'm talking general. That as human beings, we need a set of rules and guidelines, to call them whatever you want to call them, values, virtues, etc., that govern our life. Okay? Our life is changing. Do we need to change those sort of rules and guidelines, or do we need to change our life, or do we have to have a combination?
If we can change them, if we are changing forever, we don't know when to start basically, and then we are moving away from the original rules and the values to start with.
Okay, an excellent point. This is, from a rational point of view, what you said is absolutely true. Is that if we keep changing, then where are you going to end? Because there is one important point, that every day is different from the previous days. Is that true or not? And nowadays, things are rapidly changing, that even we can say at the moment, this moment is different from previous moments. As an example of that, after 9/11, the whole world is different from the world before 9/11. As simple as that. Before internet, the whole world is different from the world after internet. Okay? So, this brings another important point. Once we speak about modernity, which era modernity refers to? Is it the time post-industrialized century? At that time, yes, maybe they discovered the transistor, maybe they invented planes. But if we look back at those inventions at that time, and those technological developments at that time, we see that, oh, this is backward. We see that we are more advanced than that time. Are you talking about an aeroplane that cannot travel to America? Now we can travel to America within a few hours. At that time, there was no internet. At that time, hardly you find telephones. Now, mobiles. I can speak now to people in Russia, to people in China. So, why don't we consider our time is the time of modernity, not that time. That time for us now is a history. Is people at that time, they were backward. They don't know anything about this technology, internet, etc., etc. Okay? And every people living at a certain period of time think that they have reached to the end or the peak of what? Technology. Advancement in technology. Is that true or not? Maybe many of you are young, but those people, yeah, of my age, I'm not that old, anyway, of my age and maybe older than me, if you ever speak to them about internet, they will never imagine it. Is that true or not? What are you talking about? What is this internet? But now, young children, they know about internet, and it is just a game for them. So why don't we consider our time now is the real modern time, and that any time before that, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is just a matter of history. It's a part of people at that time. So who said that maybe after 10 years from now, things will be changing and dramatically changing? Because technology is advanced very quickly, and we might have many new technologies that we never thought of at this time. So do we say that time, that future that will come needs modernity, or our time needs modernity, or 10 years before now needs modernity, and so on and so forth? This is another important point, rational argument about the issue of modernity. The other thing about modernity, when we say a change, when we say change, when do we decide that we need a change? At which particular point we say that this set of rules and guidelines are not any more applicable to our situation? When do we say that? Is it now? And how do we say that? Is it in Europe? What about America? Maybe America is more advanced than us from many aspects. So do we say that they need to change the set of rules and guidelines and values, and we as people in Europe have to have different set of values and guidelines, etc.? What about people in Africa? Do we say that they need a different set of rules and guidelines because they are really backward people, and so on and so forth? Now, some people might propose this and say, yes, this is what we need. Each society has its own cultural aspects and has its own set of rules and guidelines that are suitable for that particular society and that are not suitable for another society. Someone might propose that. Do you agree with me or not? Yeah? Does it look a good proposal? It might look a good proposal. That yes, we need here in Europe different set of rules and guidelines, values, and in America we need another set of rules and guidelines, in Africa and in Arab world, etc. But question, do the thinkers agree on this? Do the politicians agree on this? Why America is worried about democracy in Iraq? Have you ever heard that thinkers in America or thinkers in the West saying that, well, equality between the two genders, between men and women, is suitable for Europe? The Arab world, they don't have this equality. They have another system that is suitable for them. We should not bother about them. Our system is good for us. Their system is good for them. Have you ever heard that? Okay, because people do not accept they say we have to have a set of rules and guidelines and values. Our set of rules and values are the best set of rules and values, and they should be imposed globally, everywhere. Democracy is the right thing. We should have democracy in Britain. Iraq people should have democracy. Saudi people should have democracy. Equality between men and women is the right thing. We should have equality here. America should have equality between two genders. And Saudi Arabia, they have to have equality between the two genders. This is what is happening now. Okay? So, this point, which is, can we say that these set of rules and guidelines are suitable for a certain period of time, but not suitable for another period of time? Is it suitable for a certain location or certain cultures, but are not suitable for another culture? Actually, we can say this from a rational point of view, but from a practical point of view, no one is saying this and no one is accepting that. So, there is a problem in keep changing those set of rules and guidelines. Remember, when we talk about set of rules and guidelines, we are talking about the major rules, guidelines, and values. We are not talking about minor issues. We are talking about the set of principles, primary or fundamental guidelines and values. So, I believe that there is a problem in that. Another point that highlights that there is a problem in that approach, again, from a rational point of view. We may reach to a point that we might think that something is right, and then 10 years down the line, think that that particular issue that we used to think that it is right, we think that it is mad, it is madness, and it is absolutely wrong. This, the human being intellect, cannot accept that. For example, just let us talk about homosexuality. Once they talk about Islam and modernity, they always bring the issue of women and equality between two genders, and they are also talking about homosexuality and the Islamic point of view towards homosexuality. Now, maybe 50 years ago, they used to consider homosexuality as what? Mental illness. Is that true or not? Now, if you are against homosexuality, you have a mental illness. Okay? Now, if someone wants to look at the history and he said, oh, just from a rational point of view, I cannot accept that something, a major practice at a certain period of time related to such relation used to be mental illness, and then just 50 years down the line, the opposite of it is mental illness. Take, for example, child abuse or pedophilia. Now it is illegal, and they are saying that it reflects mental illness as well, and interrupted behavior or psychological problem. Who knows? Maybe 20 years from now, a child abuse will not be considered a child abuse. It will be considered between love. It will be considered as love. A man of 50 years of age, he loved a child, maybe 6 years of age, both love each other. What is the point here? Why do you stop them from loving each other? And I heard that there are groups in Canada, and someone told me that there is a group in Europe marching for this, to allow the sexual relationship between men, children, and vice versa. So, what assurance this modernity can give me, or this approach can give me, in order to make sure that this child abuse or pedophilia will not be a legal practice in Europe? There is a big question. Okay? That's why this first approach, which is what? What was the first approach?
Changing the rules.
Changing the set of rules, guidelines, values, in order to fit into what? The changes in our life. Now, if we talk about this and we mention this criticism against this approach, now we need to mention the criticism against the second approach, which is we don't want to change those values and guidelines, but we need to change what? Our life to match those set of rules and guidelines. But I think all of us do not accept this approach. Yeah? It's just by simple logic, we can't accept it. We cannot say we need to stop internet, we need to stop technology, we need to stop airplanes, etc., etc., we need to stop all this advancement in medicine, because we don't have set of rules and guidelines that match them. So the best approach is what? It is to have set of rules and guidelines that cannot change, and we don't change them. In the meantime, having some other rules and guidelines that can change in order to fit those changes in our life. Similarly, we need maybe to stop, suppress certain changes in our life to match those rules and guidelines that cannot be changed. Once we talk about those set of rules and guidelines that cannot change and should not be changed, we are talking about the main principles and guidelines. And those set of rules and guidelines that are changeable, that can change, they should fit into the basic principles that cannot change. So you will have a dynamic system that is a set of values or virtues that are applicable for any time, any place, and they are strong enough and unchangeable enough in order to stand firmly against so many changes. Within those set of rules and guidelines, you have flexibility to have another set of rules and guidelines that can fit into the changes in our life. Similarly, we need, as we said, that we need to have this strong set of rules and guidelines that stand firmly and strongly, they should have the ability to force those changes in our life that do not match our original values to change. So those values are strong, standing strongly, and they have to be strong enough to change those it changes in our life to match them. And that is the Islamic proposal. That, let me just finish this point. What Islam is? Islam is a set of principles, values, that no one can change them. Within those set of rules and guidelines, there are some other rules and guidelines that can a change, or basically that can change during implementation, let us put it that way, to fit into the changes in our life. And those, the other changes in our life, we have to stop them in order to fit into our original values. In Europe now, in the Western world, they are talking about moral decline, rapid moral decline. What we say as Muslims, we say that if we are following this scheme, where we have set of values that cannot change, then this moral decline will not take place, because those set of rules and guidelines will prevent this moral decline, will stop this moral decline. Now, what is the time? No, I mean, what? How many minutes? Okay, I need 10-15 minutes maximum, okay? Because anyway, we started late. Okay. The question is, if someone is listening to this argument and this analogy carefully, he said the problem is what? The problem is, who decides which set of rules and guidelines cannot be changed, and which set of rules and guidelines can be changed? And who decides that those changes in our life should go back to the original situation, and those changes in our life are acceptable changes, and we should go along with them, we should accept them? This is the big question. But let us first set the foundation. Let us first agree that there should be set of rules and guidelines, principles, values, virtues that are not changeable. They don't accept any change. And let us accept as well that some changes in our life should be stopped in order to match those values. By the way, recently, you know, when they had this this debate about lesbians having children and in the House of Lords, just last week. Okay, are you aware of this debate? And then they allowed lesbians to have this. Not adoption. Yeah, in order to have children, so they can become pregnant, etc. Okay, so I read in one of these magazines that The Light, I think, or the London paper, in the Tube, and they were just listening to some people were saying, commenting about this, and someone, most of the people said this is mad, and someone said, well, we have to accept that there is a positive discrimination and a negative discrimination. But we have to have a discrimination, otherwise we will go mad. Another one said, this is all about equality. But still, even with that, they need the sperm of a man. So even with this equality, they still need the sperm of a man. Okay? They have not reached maybe to a level where they take a cell from a woman and they produce a child from it. Okay, but maybe after some time, if they reach to that level, then they will ask for it. And maybe, as some people proposed, after some time, maybe we will have another suffragette or feminist movement who will ask doctors and medicine to produce a way where men can be pregnant and men can breastfeed out of equality. Who knows that this will never happen. Now they are talking about homosexuality between animals. So who knows, where are we going to stop? Anyway, so someone here, the question is, who will decide the set of rules and guidelines that cannot change, and the set of rules and guidelines who can change? We claim as Muslims, based on what I said before, we believe that we have been created by our Lord. And we believe, as a simple rational analogy, that the creator of something, he is the one who knows everything about that created being. So we say that our Lord is the one to decide about those set of rules and guidelines that cannot change, and the other set of rules and guidelines that can be changed. If we want to dig more about this question, but I don't think that we have time, more time to dig about this question. But I wanted to speak about ijtihad and the role of ijtihad in terms of changing some of those rules and guidelines in order to fit into our changes in our life. But maybe there is no time. The last point that I would like to mention here, just before I conclude, is that once we say Islam, if we go back to the original definition of Islam, we said Islam is to submit to the will of God. To submit to the will of God in what? In political aspects of our life, in social aspects, on spiritual aspects, we said in everything. During this industrialized revolution and modernism and postmodernism, the people totally ignored the spiritual side of their life. And that's why we see, just simply, that the most industrialized countries having the highest rate in people committing suicide. Now, if industry and technology brings happiness to people, why do we see this phenomenon? Why do we see that in industrialized countries, the people consuming, the people are consuming antidepressant drugs more than what they do in other countries? So it means that industry and technology both cannot bring happiness to human beings. There is another dimension, another aspect that can bring this happiness to people in order to attain the final, or in order to attain the goal of any human being, which is to live in tranquility and peace. That's why we say, although we have said that there are certain aspects of Islam that can change in order to fit into these changes in our life, but there is another dimension in our religion that those changes are in desperate need of, which is the spiritual side. The spiritual side, mainly the link between the person and his creator. And in any human being, there is a vacuum. And that big vacuum, which is the link between him and his creator, and feeling obedience to a superior entity, that vacuum cannot be fulfilled unless the person is submitting and truly submitting to his creator, and he found that his creator is the one he has to submit to. Not he is submitting to any superpower or any superior entity. So that vacuum cannot be fulfilled except when the person submits to the will of his Lord in all aspects of his life, and that is, in a nutshell, what Islam teaches us. I hope that I have given at least my view about the relationship between Islam and modernity. I hope that I have highlighted some aspects of this important topic in a way that may trigger so many questions in the audience mind, and this is maybe the main purpose of this lecture. Just think about some of what I have said. Of course, you should not accept it immediately, but think about it, go and see whether it is true or it is not. Okay, thank you very much.
JazakAllah for our first guest speaker, Sheikh Haytham Al-Haddad. Sheikh Haytham began by calling for a reconciliation of terms. He then went to talk on the etymology of Islam, its philosophy, and its understanding as identified in the sources. He then brushed upon the possibilities of how to merge between principles and modern thrusts. His ideal proposal fits in accurately with mainstream Muslim understanding by upholding the certain legal maxims, but nonetheless acknowledging what jurists would call al-urf, or community or regional customs. He then concluded by recognizing the all-compassing nature of Islam, with extra emphasis on its spiritual dimensions. Our second speaker for tonight is Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad. He graduated from Cambridge University with a double first in Arabic in 1983. He then lived in Cairo for 3 years, studying Islam under traditional teachers at Al-Azhar, one of the oldest universities in the world. He went on to reside for 3 years in Jeddah, where he administered a commercial translation office and maintained close contact with Habib Ahmed Mashhur Al-Haddad and other ulama from Hadramaut in Yemen. In 1989, Sheikh Abdul Hakim returned to England and spent 2 years at the University of London learning Turkish and Farsi. Since 1992, he has been a doctoral student at Oxford University, specializing in the religious life of the early Ottoman Empire. He is currently Secretary of the Muslim Academic Trust in London and Director of the Sunnah Project at the Center of Middle Eastern Studies at Cambridge University, which issues the first ever scholarly Arabic editions of the major hadith collections. Sheikh Abdul Hakim is a translator of a number of works, including 2 volumes of Imam Ghazali's Ihya Ulumuddin. He gives durus and halaqas from time to time and taught the works of Imam al-Ghazali at the winter 1995 Dean Intensive Program in New Haven. He appears frequently on BBC Radio and writes occasionally for a number of publications, including The Independent, Q News International, Britain's premier Muslim magazine, and Seasons, the semi-academic journal of Zaytuna Institute. One of the not-so-known talents of the Sheikh is his singing. He has his own nasheed group called Harmonia Al-Qurani, which started off with a group of Cambridge students. One of them is amongst us today, C.V. Riyad Khan. The songs are based on Muslims in the British Isles, with particular references to the songs composed by Sheikh Al-Islam of England, Sir Abdullah Quilliam from Liverpool. Samples of these songs can be found on www.britishmuslimsongs.co.uk. With regards to today's topic, I can now add to the uniqueness of this personality, the uniqueness of his input, which we shall see before us, inshallah. The Sheikh has also written many articles which relate to today's topic in some way or the other, British and Muslim, tradition or extradition, Muslim loyalty and beginning, Muslims and the European right, are just some of the titles that come to mind. I now call upon our second guest speaker, Sheikh Abdul Hakim.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, salatu wassalamu ala rasulillah, wa alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. Time is pressing a little bit, so I'll confine myself to a few general reflections. And perhaps now, unlike the situation, say, 20 years ago when one gave talks along these lines, it's helpful to begin by distancing oneself from a certain naive triumphalism that sometimes invades Muslim discourse. Muslim world is the last refuge of sanity, buttress, a rock of ages against which the waves of cruel and relativizing modernity fruitlessly clash. The reality is that the Muslim world's engagement with modernity has not been based on much intelligence, much analysis, or much wisdom, or much beauty. One can detect that very readily from any newspaper, east or west. Part of the problem is a reluctance to analyze. Muslims in the Muslim world often complain about places like this. Knowledge is power, is the motto. Orientalism. It's an evil agenda calculated to provide an ideology for expropriation, conquest, economic rapaciousness. But nonetheless, the institutions of the getting able to understand many all dimensions of other cultures, including the Islamic. The Muslim world, in its response to modernity, has not reciprocated. There are no centers in the Muslim world where one can genuinely, profoundly study the West and the phenomenon as a historical tradition, its pros and its cons. There are a few exceptions now. You can study something that looks roughly like Western studies in one or two places in Turkey, for instance, perhaps in Indonesia. But by and large, the Muslim world's response to modernity has been based on gut reaction and emotiveness and simple sloganeering rather than a profound intellectual understanding of what it might represent. And the consequences of that, of course, have been disastrous for everyone, not just for the West's attempt to extract some sense out of Muslim discourse, but also for the objective situation of just about every Muslim collectivity today. The Middle East in particular is a realm of categoric failure, diplomatic failure, military failure, economic failure, cultural failure. All they seem to be able to do is to build skyscrapers as in Dubai, and somehow that's regarded as a massive achievement, as if civilization engagement with modernity in traditional cultures is nothing other than replicating Las Vegas in the desert, because you've got different billions to burn. The latest example of this catastrophic failure to engage intelligently with modernity is in the Holy City of Mecca itself. The new spire that is being built more or less on top of the Kaaba could be 1.5 times taller than the Empire State Building, 600 meters high, full of flats only to millionaires, with a huge clock, the world's biggest clock at the top, which looks like Big Ben gone wrong. They're also happy. MashaAllah, Islam's really getting into the modern world. And to do that, they had to smash historic remains, archaeological sites, the whole way of life, civilization, without anybody really thinking that perhaps this was a strange way of engaging with modernity. So what the Muslim world can't really do is to get on its high horse and say, well, we've got the relationship right. Everybody is experiencing the clash of the ancient and the modern as something that perhaps has no solution. But what is this modern juggernaut which we have to engage with on some level? Is it inevitably godless and secular? George Bush, the one would say no. It's a Christian vision of how to control the world in the name of global capital, a prosperity gospel. Others would say, yes, of course, it is inevitably secular because it's based on the Enlightenment was an anti-Christian movement, anti-clerical, anti-theistic, anti-sacred, in the name of science, progress, rationality, and equality. So even in the West, nobody's quite agreed as to what the importance of religion, modernity, might engender. And in the Muslim world, people really don't have a clue. That's why they shout so much, because they're panicking. Now, when we're trying to get our heads around this phenomenon, we notice that it's endlessly diverse, but that it does have certain key features on which religion has to have a view. And let me take them in no particular order. One of them would be the idea that the natural order, or the Quran, or the signs that are yet, are not meaningful. They might have a private meaning to poets and theologians, as long as they don't actually contribute substantially to the public debate and the public culture. The world is matter. Human beings ultimately are matter. There's no ghost in the machine, in the brain, we are ultimately material. And even human consciousness, which the Enlightenment itself thought was going to be the center of the new age, the uplifting of humanity through humanism, has been deconstructed and analyzed and more or less abolished as something that is not material by the scientists, by the philosophers, the philosophy of mind, particularly. We're not really sure what we are. Nonetheless, the modern paradox is you will find fulfillment and happiness not as the ancients used to through the classical wisdom or service of God or a range of gods, but through seeing yourself and self-discovery. And the whole message of modernity, whether it be in its commercial or its entertainment or its other modalities, is about being yourself and hence being free. The equality discourse comes under that head. Democracy comes under that head. Freedom of expression. It's all about the liberation of the self. But then the scientists and the philosophers are saying we're not really sure we have a definition of what the human self is. look at this precious thing that has to abrogate so many other things, and you're not actually sure that what intellectual is more than a bundle of sense perceptions, vague memories. Are you really in continuity with the same person you want to sleep in the bed the night before, or is it just rebooting the computer? We don't really have a definition. What is consciousness? Can it be replicated artificially? That's the latest thing that we have to unravel. Professor of LSE recently says he reckons by the time he retires, he'll be able to upload his brain waves onto the internet and will be immortal, floating around somewhere in cyberspace when after his body goes into the crematorium. What's more, even more interesting, he says he can make copies of his consciousness on CDs and put them to his friends. That's the prevailing paradigm now, and it's fairly scary. And we tend not to look it in the eye. But nonetheless, more intelligent people are worried about the long-term implications of this definition of the human subject. The German philosopher Jürgen Habermas recently produced a book, and he says, we're the last generation of human beings. Because we are now at the historic point where we can reinvent even the genetic biological matrix, which is the ground of our consciousness. And he says the technology is there, the human will is certainly there, the corporations are certainly itching to go. It's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 generations. And a lot of recent fiction is about that. Some of you might have seen the recent book by Michel Houellebecq, the right-wing French novelist, very polemical anti-Muslim right-wing figure, which is all about the next generation, where human beings genuinely will be able to have their entire biological matrix scanned. Everything in the brain, which is after all nothing but electrical impulses skipping backwards and forth, scanned. And so a replica of oneself can be made at the moment of death. And is it actually yourself in continuity with this new life form or not? This is sort of the basis of the story. Is this going to replace religion? Because it's the more very interesting kind of not quite fantasy any longer. So part of the problem Muslims and everybody is going to have, anybody who wants to put the brakes on a little bit, is that we don't really know what the end game is. It's like so many things that bother us in today's world. What about the Iraq war? We don't know where that will end. What about Israel? Will it end with another Holocaust or with the greater Israel or what? Everything seems to be possible. And this fundamental project of modernity, which is reinventing the human subject, has an outcome which is really unguessable. That's part of the problem we have in assessing this thing called the modern world. We don't know where it's taking us, because earlier generations of human beings, earlier civilizations, had an ideal or an objective. Classical Christian civilization says the purpose of human life is to be saved, which means imitating Christ. But the Buddhists have their own vision. Muslims certainly have their own vision, which is based on nowadays, it's about becoming something that's out there in the future, possible, perfected, or certainly radically improved human being, and everything in our lives is desiring that reality, in a sort of constant questing for something that actually has never existed. And that's part of the kind of makeshift and improvised and often quite unsatisfied atmosphere that characterizes so much modern culture, this sense of incompleteness, expectation of what surely when it comes will be very unexpected. So we have in Cambridge, where I'm from, our professor of astronomy, Martin Rees, recently produced a book called, it's called Our Last 100 Years, Our Final Century. He says, modernity has given us central heating and nice dentists, but in fact, with every new scientific paradigm shift, there is a new threat to the survival of the species. And as those threats accumulate, sooner or later, one of them's going to get us. Will it be nanotechnology? Will it be genetic engineering? Will it be some new disease? Will it be some unexpected nuclear thing? Will it be those experiments of the European Atomic Particle Research Centre in Geneva, where they recently sent off a report to the European Union saying, give us another few million euros for our next experiment. And by the way, there's a chance that if the experiment succeeds, it will bring an end to the physical universe. And so the kind of bureaucrats in Brussels wondered about this and said, what's the probability? And it was like 0.0001%, and so they said, all right, and they got the money. How exactly that's calculated, I don't know. So physicists, I don't understand it at all. But Martin's point is that the chances are we're not going to survive for another 100 years, because one of these threats is going to get us.
So the benefit is strange two-edged sword. Any religious appreciation or criticism of it has to be ambivalent. Clearly there are things that have benefited us enormously. It's nice, if you're married, not to have 15 children, too many to survive. You can't deny that that's progress. On the other hand, if it's going to kill us all through environmental degradation or some amazing supernuclear conflict that catches us unawares, it's not so great. We're in a state of heightened fear, but also heightened expectation. So, what should the response be? Well, religionists need to recede from any large, grandiose claim that they can offer an alternative that is not profoundly shaped by the inescapable logic of the scientific world. There are certain economic forms, certain styles of life, certain medical practices, certain styles of agriculture that you can't now get back to because the world's population is simply too big. People generally don't want to get back to this. The full traditionalism doesn't really exist anywhere. Nobody's saying, let's go back to how things were. People are saying, let's be collective. Like the Saudis saying, well, we still want to go around the Kaaba, but we also want to have this big giant clock winking at us with the laser beam, and this big laser beam. That's our understanding of what we're going to accept, what we're going to reject. And we have to do rather better than that, Islamic civilization in particular. Because the quality of Islam is, although it's present in other religions, is preeminently that of trying to maintain the integrity and the continuity of the human subject. We are enfleshed human beings. The modernity is trying to cultivate new things to desire, new styles of life, new ways of decorating ourselves, new forms of sexuality. Islam has to have something to say about those things. Why? Because it says you're in us and it's up to you, you're in the best forms already, actually, or potentially. The ideal is back there, 1400 years ago, well documented. You don't have to look forward to some android that you might become 200 years. The reality is already there. The Muslim life is shaped around the faithful, loving emulation of an actual human being. And that is going to have a very profound effect on the way Muslims deal with the modern predicament. And it almost seems designed for that. Everything in the Muslim life is about bringing together the human subject, body and soul. Famously, Muslims have all kinds of rules about what you can eat, what you can't eat, how you cut your hair, how you trim your fingernails, how you wash in the bathroom. Everything seems to be regulated there. And the point of that is that everything you do is to reshape yourself, first of all, after the model of the chosen one. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, which is what Islam is all about. Choosing his way, not choosing what you feel like doing. Secondly, in order to uplift you, so that the spirit is present in what you do. So that even when you're cleaning your teeth, there is a way of doing that is an objectively right way of doing that. And therefore, the Muslim, as he or she proceeds to the world, is genuinely a different kind of entity. Such a person has taken the decision to step outside the global market and the monoculture, outside the world of branding and the standard youth culture that's now almost universal in today's world. And is in a genuinely different space. That is the exit we're going to be following the summer. But there are other aspects to that as well. What does one do if one finds the modern condition degrading? What if you actually don't like the kind of world that Gordon Brown likes? And the West is asking Muslims what we really think, just as we're asking them what they really think. And our question as Muslims to the modern world is, when you talk about difference and pluralism and diversity, do you really mean that? Do you really mean that there can be places in the world where the laws are really different? Or do you mean that people can have ethnic costumes and speak the Iranian and perhaps speak different languages? But when it comes to the public space, the public law, public morality, it's the white man rules for everybody. And the West hasn't really given the Muslim model a persuasive answer. And what many Muslims are suspecting, basically correctly, is that because the modern process, let's not even call it the Western process, it's everywhere. Modern process is totalizing. It doesn't actually leave space to real global diversity. It doesn't allow the
public expression of other people's dreams, even if those dreams can only be themselves if they have public expression. Just go into your little picturesque temple or mosque. Public space is Kentucky Fried Chicken and lesbian dating. That's the model. Now, what does the believer do if he really doesn't like that? And we saw the case 2 years ago of Rocco Buttiglione, who's the European Commissioner, who had to resign his position because he said his conscience as a Catholic said he had to personally find homosexuality unacceptable. He had to resign because that's not the new totalizing single view that the European reality now expects in the public space. And the Muslims, they're at similar crises, and they're going to be more and more as the inherent intolerance of this reportedly tolerant liberal or neoliberal global order starts to bite. And already in the world, there are points where there are militant engagements between the two worldviews. What is the intelligent response as opposed to keep on going around the Kaaba? But actually, it's the design, the original design for this new thing in Mecca is Moscow University, which is the great Stalinist showpiece. You Google it up on the internet, you can see the new tower in Mecca, put it next to Moscow University, it's identical. It's crescent on the top instead of the hammer and sickle, otherwise it's the same building. Of course, the laser beam is new as well. That's not a good response to modernity, really. In fact, sooner or later, that's going to produce such a schism in your soul as you go out of your crystal establishment and into the harem. There's going to be some kind of schizophrenia that will tear your society apart, which is starting to happen, which will tear your soul apart, which is starting to happen as well. That's not sustainable. It has to be smarter than that. So, what does the Muslim do? The Muslim who's in a state of panic says, blow it up. Attack the symbols of it. The World Trade Center, the Pentagon, the cut off the head of the snake. It's evil. Most Muslims know intuitively that that's neither smart nor is it ethical. Muslims are supposed to be on a higher moral plane rather than just slashing stuff up like small sports or in the playground. What is the correct response? Do we just kind of keep our heads down and hope things get better, knowing that given the nature of the modern steamroller, it won't? It's going to get more and more weird. What is the correct response? Well, the first response, the duty, is the individual duty, the follow time, which is keep up with the practices. Follow the sunnah as much as you can, in your personal life, in your personal way, and also in relationships, in whatever space you can make the sunnah a reality, so you have a genuine alternative in an increasingly monolithic, monocultural world, where you can be yourself in continuity with your heritage, and also in a state that is in continuity with the body, with traditional human ways of being, one of the last refuges which is still available for that. But what about public space? The ulama aren't sure. Nobody's quite sure about this. Is it the obligation of Muslims to go out and try and tear down the whole thing with our bare hands because it's dreadful? Very few of the real ulama actually adopt that stance. And in fact, one of the most striking things of Muslim history in the past 200 years is that the great ulama and their institutions have been quiet. In the colonial period, 19th century Algeria, they were fighting in the Caucasus, they were fighting in Somaliland, they were fighting. But by and large, that their sense was that there needs to be an eschatological wisdom. Because the hadith indicate that there will be an end time, we don't know that that's our time, but there will be an end time when people are building skyscrapers and when there are extreme differences between rich and poor and strange sexual games and the gender balance is unbalanced. That's all foretold in prophecy. And what you do in that time, well, called Hinsen Ahlati Baitik, be a piece of furniture in your house. And that time, that Al-Qa'im will be her khayrun min Al-Qa'im. One who sits is better than the one who stands. Al-Qa'im will be her khayrun min Al-Mashi. The one who stands is better than the one who walks, etc. Consistent prophetic guidance, keep your head down when things are really bad. The ulama say, is there an analogy between that wise counsel and another time that looks a bit like that time, according to all traditional standards? but may well not be that time. And that's where the difference emerges. Do you go out prophetically and try and change things by force if necessary, or do you just keep your head down following this other prophetic model? Or, to take another example, the model of Imam Hussein, the model of Imam Hassan, which do you choose? Well, as I said, the classical wisdom of the classical ulama was the quietest option, but to build up institutions and to try and understand what's going on. Generally, they didn't have the resources to do that. There are very few Muslims who have a sophisticated deep discourse, understanding what modernity is really all about. And sometimes it's quite shocking. There are Western Muslims who, because they inhabit both worlds, have been able to do it. But if you take their books to traditional scholars and traditional people in the Middle East, for instance, and Pakistan, the scholars there simply can't understand. They just don't get it. Because they haven't really been trained to think in these abstract terms. When they talk about modernity, they talk about specific issues, usually moral issues, and usually issues of sexual morality. That's 99% of the khutbahs when they deal with the horrors of the modern world. The other thing that Islam has to say, other areas of the Sharia, other areas of modernity, they kind of get blanked out because they're kind of positive. But what should be the generic temper of our response? Well, we know that our civilization is a diverse civilization. And the kind of Islam that we choose is going to have momentous consequences for the viability of Islam and Muslim societies as we move into these increasingly strange times and conditions. Walk into any classical Muslim library, and you'll see a number of things. Firstly, you'll see that civilization was very verbose. They produced millions of books. And you'll also see that it was very diverse. Classical Islam was not like classical Western Christendom, where there was a Pope and a single orthodoxy. If you didn't follow it, you were up on a stake. Muslim world, sometimes to its detriment, was really diverse. The Muslims now looking at that heritage saying we want to be in continuity with our past have to choose what sort of Islamic past they want to base their Islamic present on. And this is where we generally mess up. Sometimes we're simply not aware that we have brilliant civilizations in the past, we just don't know. That's increasingly common as we become more and more disconnected from the great ulama. Sometimes we allow ourselves to be driven not by wisdom and by a certain wise pessimism about what can actually be achieved in the face of the global juggernaut. And we allow our emotions to take over. And we say, the authentic form of Islam today is the narrowest form we can find and the angriest form. I'm scared. I want to express that in terms of anger. I want to lash out. I want a vindictive response to the fact that the modern world really despises me. And that's why we have so many khutbahs that are just yelling and shouting and cursing around Israel and Zionism and conspiracies. And that's just kind of the ulama. The circuits are fused and they can't deal with it. Therefore, they collapse into just emotion, gut reactions, and the masses can respond to that. If you use that as the basis for choosing, where you're going to stand on the classical Sunni Islamic spectrum, you're going to gravitate towards the most intransigent classical voices, and you're going to be so narrow-minded, so arrogant, so angry, so dominated by the desire for revenge, and so angry with other Muslims who don't conform to your particular vision, that you're actually going to accelerate the secularization process in your country, because your alternative is clearly unrealistic, angry, ugly, stupid. And that's the great crisis of the modern Islamic world, which is called upon to provide a great oasis of an alternative to the mediocrities of modernity, but in reality, it's just another zone laying out of some of modernity's negative consequences. The great challenge facing Muslims today is to choose how to gain continuity with their past on the basis of the deep human need for spirituality, for human sanity, for the human need for beauty, the human need for mercy, for forgiveness, and an awareness that everybody today is really weak, really confused, and that a very, very judgmental sort of religion is simply inappropriate. It simply is not right for this age. The puritanical fury of the Taliban isn't going to fly under today's conditions, that kind of
us with one way of righteousness is not what is going to be viable. And this doesn't mean we need an Islamic Reformation, Islamic reform, progressive Islam at all. What it means is that we have to choose that area of that bandwidth in the traditional spectrum that is about mercy, that is about wisdom, that is about inclusiveness, that is about openness and mutuality. And alhamdulillah, we find that in our heritage. It's the middle of our heritage. It's not one of the extremes. But that's the key. That's the challenge. The Muslim response to modernity. Don't put anger where usul al-fiqh ought to be. Dealing with the modern world is an issue for the fiqh and for lots of other Islamic disciplines as well. And it has to be dealt with coolly and objectively on the basis of a real assessment of people's weakness, not on the basis of people's rage and fury. If you follow the way of rage and fury, you're just going to give the modern world more reasons to reject Islam. And increasingly, you'll find that your own people, especially the young people, start to run away. Anyway, I'm going to stop now. Your patience. And I think we have time for some questions. Yes, Fran. Yes. Yes.
Alhamdulillah, that was a very enlightening speech there by Sheikh Abdul Hakim. Without further digression, we have 15 minutes for question and answers. The first question I would like to pose to you. Should you start first, please?
Yes, I'm looking. Just got a very good question. I'm sharing this platform we're talking about today. My question is that in this ever-changing world, is it a necessity for Muslims to react to modernity by taking Islamic doctrine more literally?
Is that for me or for you? Since you actually arrived on time, and I think you have the right to speak first.
Yes. I'd love to hear from you.
Doctrine is an interpretation. Therefore, the interpretation doesn't need to be reinterpreted. What is required is, as I indicated, that we have this huge spectrum in our heritage of people who use an absolute literalism in interpreting the Quran and the Hadith, and other people who want to incorporate aspects of public interest, the consensus of the community, their own insights, a variety of other things that the Mujtahid can legitimately invoke. We have that spectrum. Maybe the Hanbalis are at one end of it, the Hanafis are at another end, there's different ways of looking at it. My experience is that the real classical ulama, if you go to the furthest oasis in Mauritania and talk to people who haven't been freaked out in any way by modernity, they will always say, give people the gentlest interpretation because that's all they can carry. And in the Ottoman period, there's a text by somebody called Mehmet bin Ali Gilgamesh, who was actually known as quite a narrow-minded scholar at this time, Thomas Suleiman Mathematism. He has a book where she talks about these general things that the Qadi and the Mujtahid ought to be guided by. And he says, he quotes somebody called Qadi Khan, who has fatwas, Hanafi fatwas from 300 years earlier. Qadi Khan says, in this age, people are so weak and so bad that it's haram to give them the harder interpretation. Always choose the softest interpretation, because otherwise they can't carry it. And then Birgadi says, well, that was 300 years ago, now things are really bad. So it's certainly haram for the Mufti or the Qadi to choose narrow interpretations. Now, he was writing at the time of Suleiman Magnificent, when the Ottoman were banging on the gates of Vienna and Istanbul was the great city of the world, and things didn't look so bad. But if that was the wisdom of the classical ulama then you find that nowadays, as I say, completely classical, traditional ulama will say, give people always the easiest answer, and then start blaming people for doing things that other ulama have found to be legitimate, because this is not an age for narrowness.
Same question.
The second speaker earlier referred to the Muslim show expressing anger at modernity or and made reference to the incident in America, basically, saying that shouldn't be the response. But I think we all very well know that those responses were not, against the modernity. They were for other, reasons, and that's in this world. So I think we need to separate between those links, basically. I think you kind of mentioned them in the previous speech.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. And it's also been pointed out by John Gray, for instance, here in London, and some commentators, that in fact the Al-Qa'ida position is in many ways more in continuity with modernity than it is in opposition to it. The whole terroristic method originates at the time of the French Revolution, targeting civilians to simply have a place in classical Sharia, the use of technology, internet, targeting economic things is something that really comes from the Western tradition of political violence and not from Islam. So that's probably true, except insofar as modernity as it is perceived oppressively impact upon the Muslim world in the Middle East is often in most Muslim minds more inseparable from the American Empire. It's certainly the case that the people journalists call fundamentalists tend to be in many ways quite modern in their perceptions, and very often a typical recruit for those movements is somebody who's deeply westernized. And in Adams or Whitehead, those people that have Western type secular education, so not traditional on that. So yeah, that's a valid point. But the larger point I suppose I was trying to illustrate perhaps inadequately with that was that there is objectively a lot of anger and rage in the Muslim world against the way in which modernity projects itself from the West politically, economically, in terms of the entertainment industry, lots of other things in the Muslim world. Israel is kind of a modern creation in the heart of the Middle East. And it's hard to differentiate between the abstractions of modernity and its actual consequences on the ground.
Any questions from the system?
I think it's quite sure. Is it something that can be updated to change the historical Sharia?
So to you want to tackle that? Please sit
down. I really like to hear from by the way, there is because the brother whom he introduced me, he said that I'm part of Islamic Sharia Council in Britain, and there will be a program about Islamic Sharia Council in Channel 4 on Monday at 7 o'clock. That's why I'd like to answer this question. And you might see my face, although I try to hide my face there. I don't want to be presented in those channels because normally, you see after that in the Sun magazine or the yeah, you will see so many criticism about it, and sometimes it's funny. In times online, maybe some of you have seen the interview with Sheikh Sohaib Hassan, the Qutb Sohaib Hassan, about Sharia in the UK, because he's the head of Islamic Sharia Council, and he clearly said, what we want is part of the Muslim personal law to be implemented and to be embedded within the British judicial system. He never mentioned, and he clearly said that we don't want this many Islamic traditions to be implemented. We are not marching for them, like stoning adulterers, cutting the hands. He said that clearly. However, it's very, very weird. I don't know what to call it, funny. When you see the comments, they all are referring to this point, that, oh, they want Sharia, and then they want to stone women, and they want to discriminate against women, and they want to do all these rubbish things that Taliban are doing. This is all their comments. I don't know whether they have read that article, or they have read another article. They have read that interview with Sheikh Sohaib, or they read another interview. So sometimes it's really, that's why I don't like to appear in these. Anyway, your point, Sharia. What is Sharia? Basically, there is a precise definition or Khasa Muhammad, the description for Khasa Muhammad.
General and specific.
Yeah, okay, maybe that is a general definition and a specific definition. The general definition of Sharia is Islam. Just simple, Islam. So that's why when people say that we don't want Sharia in England, we say that actually many parts of Sharia are already implemented in England. How? We have so many mosques. What do you call mosques? Okay, is it part of Sharia or not? No, even more than that. Halal, the word halal became part of this Webster dictionary. the word halal. Okay, so this is part of Sharia, halal. Yeah, you have to slaughter and you can't eat dead flesh or dead meat. Okay, so this is part of Sharia. Women, the sisters are wearing hijab, this is part of Sharia. So Sharia from that angle is a very general term. From the specific meaning, which very few scholars refer to, that Sharia linguistically is the path for sustenance or the source of water. Okay, that's why they say Sharia is anything that brings about sustenance for you. And I think in this place we have last year, we gave a lecture about Sharia. Last year we gave a lecture about Sharia and we mentioned those two things. And we, yeah, we mentioned that the specific meaning that some scholars refer to when they speak about Sharia, they are speaking about certain certain penal codes. Okay. However, most of the scholars you see when they refer to Sharia, they are referring to Sharia in its general meaning. And I do remember that when I mentioned this, one of the audience, he said, so spirituality, is it part of Sharia or is not part of Sharia? No, spirituality is part of Sharia because you pray according to Sharia. Is that true or not? And as Sheikh Abdul Hakim said, you clean your teeth is not a technical process that is totally isolated from the spiritual side. We clean our teeth and we try to bring about the intention behind the cleaning the teeth, which is to السواك مطهرة للثم مرباة للرب, to please our Lord as well. So this is spirituality part of it, and this is part of Sharia. So this is the definition of Sharia as I have this study.
Okay, we have time for one quick question.
Yes, this is the definition.
Do you think that can what you're listed and whatever it means, it's usually used as a way of Muslims who are wearing the Islamic clothing or the Sunnah to be seen not to be moderate? Because in Islam we are by definition on the middle way, as it says in the second chapter of the Quran, we're a balanced Ummah, a balanced nation. So do you think that the term the Muslim Muslim is a way of the Muslims trying to communicate each other from the outside or not?
This term moderate Muslim is something I think we should not use, because in the mentality of the journalistic or political community, I think what it means is Muslims who aren't too Muslim. In other words, they don't have too much of that Islam. Just have a bit. And Islam is not a spectrum like that. We don't say you can be too Muslim. You can't have too much to be mad. You can't have too many good things about you, too many virtues. It's not as if it was between two extremes, too much or too little. So I think the word is a bad one. We don't really find it in our vocabulary or in our tradition. But what we need to do is, rather than put up with being defined by others, try and create our own vocabulary or establish our own vocabulary in the public space. And they talk about Islam so much and they say they're so concerned about Islam that they really ought to start to see to start using indigenous Islamic vocabulary. After all, we don't talk about Catholic imams, for instance, because we don't want to know what a priest is. We use their vocabulary. It's time that they started to use Islamic vocabulary, and then it'll actually be easier for them to understand what's going on. This term moderate Muslim, I think, is dangerous because it suggests that they want us to be a bit less Muslim. Nobody's going to accept that. In terms of the dress issue, what they make of it is generally neither here nor there. Certain forms of the niqab can have, in the eyes of many scholars, a negative consequence in a minority Muslim situation if it can be shown to frighten people away from Islam, in which case it can be a problem. But the hijab is something that's not negotiable, that's it's showing our requirements. Whether it's defined as moderate or immoderate by outsiders is not really a concern to us. Because we're not going to change people. And the question is,
is there no sense in just sort of speaking about this present being sort of realm of modernity, discourse of multiple modernities? Is there much sense in talking about Islamic modernity? useful for that.
Well, I think that you can use such terms, but generally don't seem to have much content. Modernity, in its most helpful sense, means that which is in authentic continuity with the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, separation of church and state, those processes through which Christendom has been over the past 400 years. And to say you can have a different definition of modernity might satisfy a certain desire for political correctness, but I don't think it might even have much substance.
Would that then somehow engage an American modernity as well? Because, for example, that continuity, what you said about there is that continuity, is questionable. So would that in turn then start to blow apart the unity or the seeming unity of the very term?
I think modernity is basically the American way and variations on it. If you're modernized around the world, that means you're to some extent conformed to the culture that's coming out of New York, Washington, Hollywood. What's curious now about America is that there's a very strong resurgence of a political religion. Last year's polls indicated that 9% of Americans want to see the Bible as the only source of legislation in America. And that's something fairly unusual. There's always been that kind of dispensationalist fundamentalism around becoming very political now. And George Bush is sort of on the soft end of that spectrum. But whether that's part of modernity or not is a more interesting question. Most people will say, no, it isn't really, because it's trying to go back to actually beyond the kind of logic that created America in the first place. It would be interesting to see how far that goes. And what the effect will be for the rest of the world if America is no longer, in its principal public expressions, committed to the classic modern model. What would it mean for demands, for the West demands, the Muslim world separate religion from state if the United States is no longer doing that? For instance, very, very profound consequences. But Bush, of course, is somewhat discredited, and it may be that that will receive another political generation.
So, for you, modernity is singular. It sort of doesn't make much sense to speak about it outside of its tradition.
I think so, unless you're going to use it in a more or less unhelpful sense and say anything that exists in the modern world is
modernity. Why do we insist on using the term modernity? Why are we not still using what in the 70s we would claim was Orientalism or Westernism or so on? So
you can use those terms. You can use those terms, but to use the term of Westernism doesn't help any longer because it's everywhere now. It's Singapore, it's Tokyo, it's Moscow, it's global. So just call it the modern world. What anarchists would call the spectacle for the capital S.
Yeah. Justin Cambridge said that we should be lenient when interpreting the Quran. Is that viable with the current leadership, Western leadership in Europe?
That's a good question. Do you want to say something briefly about that? The current Muslim leadership in Europe, is it well equipped to follow the Rukhs in the Sharia, or is it too narrow-minded? Okay. As I write a lot about Islamic finance, and Islamic finance is one of my main concerns, I look at it like this. There are certain leniencies and rukhs, exceptions and lean opinions that are acceptable in general from an Islamic point of view, from a juristic point of view. But there are some rukhs or lenient opinions that are not acceptable from an Islamic point of view. Yes, they might be more lenient for Muslims living in the West. Okay. Some forms of hijab easy for women to wear here. Don't be so strict in terms of riba. Just be a bit lenient towards some transactions because you are living in the West. How do I see it? I see if you have a very valuable, let us say, very valuable car, okay, prestigious car, and they say, don't put unleaded fuel. Just use leaded fuel, okay? Then, even if that is easier for you to use,
you will not choose to go for the easy option because you know that the easy option has so many negative consequences on the machine itself, on the long run. Okay? So there are some lenient opinions and exceptions that can, you can find a backing evidence for them. But don't look at the small picture whether they are easier for people in the West to adopt, but look at the global picture, whether those on the long run will be harmful for the society or better for the society. That's why you need deep knowledge in terms of understanding and in terms of the situation in order to judge which lenient opinion can be really adopted and which is not. So it is not a matter of that the lenient opinion is easier for people to adopt. That's why we should give it to people. But lenient opinions may bring harm for us. And we have seen this clearly in terms of Islamic finance. I'm giving it as an example. Because why Allah Jalla wa Ala prohibited riba? It is not because riba is something that Allah Jalla wa Ala does not like full stop. But because riba, Allah Jalla wa Ala does not like riba, and riba brings injustice in the world. Brings corruption, brings fasad. Okay? Brings all immoral transactions. That's why we have to be strict when we talk about, for example, riba and all related transactions that can be overlooked, which are linked to riba. From that angle, because we don't want these transactions, although we might find lenient opinions about them, we don't want these transactions to bring about injustice in the world. We don't want them to bring harm to the whole society. And moreover, if we start doing that in certain opinions that are, that can bring injustice, Muslims, non-Muslims will say, as they say about so many so-called Islamic models, Islamic mortgages, okay? They have said this about so many Islamic mortgages. They said, well, if Islamic mortgage is this, and our mortgage is that, okay? Then what is the real difference, and what contribution the prohibition of riba brought to us, to humanity? Because literally, or almost literally, they are both the same. You got it. That's why, no, we said no. Yes, this might be a lenient opinion that some scholars adopt, but the vast majority of scholars do not adopt. Moreover, this lenient opinion on the long run will bring corruption and will bring so many harms in the society, as well as it does not give the good and the best picture of an Islam from a global side. Yeah, this is.
Okay, now that we come to an end of tonight's speech and the end to the Islamic Awareness Week, I'd like to call upon Siti Hassan to make some important announcements before we leave.